Almost. Spinning over here. We live. Come on. Oh, there we go. We are live, ladies and gentlemen. So there's been a lot of interesting news stories going on over the past week. We've got bridges collapsing in Baltimore. We've got states divesting from BlackRock. We've got media revolts happening against people that are hired at NBC, apparently. So I want to spend some time talking about all of these stories and perhaps another, if time permits, because all of these stories exposes truths about some of the most important things going on in our country right now. So join us as we talk about all these topics and more on episode 442 of the In the Tank podcast. Welcome to the In the Tank podcast. As always, I'm your host, Donald Kendall. Joining me, I've got Jim Lakely, VP of the Heartland Institute. How are you doing today, good sir?
I'm doing good. It's Easter week. Today is Holy Thursday, and tomorrow's Good Friday. And so I'm wishing everybody a happy Easter. If you're wondering why we're going to be talking about something as inconsequential as a former Republican National Committee Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel being fired after 48 hours of being hired by MSNBC, it's not just because I love to rant about media bias, which I do. It's also because I think it really exposes kind of the mindset of the left and what we have in store for us as the election gets closer.
Absolutely. Chris Talgo, editorial director here at the Heartland Institute. How are you doing today, good sir?
Doing good. And this is also a holiday for me because it's opening day for Major League Baseball. So
Is it now? All right. Good.
Chicago Cubs are taking on the World Series champion Texas Rangers. So let's go.
Oh man, I will root for the Cubs so hard, not necessarily for their own welfare, but just to spite H. Sterling Burnett from our climate realism show. But anyways, we've got a lot of stuff to talk about. But before we get into any of it, I have to put that message out that I put at the beginning of all of these episodes, which is if you want to help the show, you can. There's a number of options that you could do. One is to support the show by using that super chat functionality that we have enabled to guarantee your comment or question is read on air. Or if you're watching on or listening, if you're listening on iTunes, you can join us a day earlier. But first off, why don't you leave a review for us on iTunes? That would be greatly appreciated. And you can also join us a day earlier on Thursdays where we're streaming this live on Facebook and YouTube and Rumble and X. If you want to join the conversation, throw your comments and questions in the chat. Maybe we'll show your comments on the screen. Maybe we'll address your questions on the fly. You can also hit that like button, subscribe, share this content, or just leave a comment under the video. All those things help break through those big tech algorithms that prevent content like this from being shown to more people. But yes, a lot of stuff to talk about. Tuesday morning, I, like probably most of you, woke up to some pretty shocking images of a massive cargo ship crashing into a support beam of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore Harbor, sending the entire bridge crashing into the water. Just some important context here. The bridge was a very important transportation route, facilitating the transportation of 11 million vehicles a year. It was also an important route for the transportation of hazmat materials. Also, the bridge's collapse effectively closes the Baltimore Harbor, which is a major economic hub of the East Coast. It's a critical port for shipping and trade, especially as it relates to transporting goods to the Mid-Atlantic region. The harbor area is home to numerous industrial facilities, including manufacturing plants, warehouses, and distribution centers. Industries such as shipbuilding, steel production, and manufacturing have historically thrived in the vicinity of that harbor. So, yes, shut down until further notice. Guess we'll see how long it takes for the cleanup mess. But don't worry, we have our best and brightest on the mission. Q beat Pete Buttigieg. But like I said, pretty shocking stuff. Jim, what were your first thoughts when you saw that video? I thought you were going to catch yourself. I thought you were going to unmute yourself just in time.
I'm sorry. I was typing in the background. I had to get this video up, so I'm sorry. Yes. Apologies. So here we have it on. If you're watching on YouTube, we have the video here in the screen on what happened, and found this on X, formerly Twitter. And, you know, it's actually quite, I mean, talk about unlucky. I mean, for the power to go out right as it's approaching this important piece of infrastructure on the East Coast, and it loses power, as you can see here, it loses power, I think, three times. And then it just starts, the current starts to take it. And then apparently they tried to drop an anchor to get it to stop, but it was just too late. And the video you're seeing here, it is sped up. But then, you know, so it would take 5 minutes for it to hit the support beam. But, you know, this is what's great about X is that if anything bad happens immediately, conspiracy theories begin. Now, I like a good conspiracy theory, but the idea that there was some at 1:30 in the morning, there was some sort of nefarious, maybe Chinese agent with some kind of jamming devices that can control the ship and all this kind of stuff seems far-fetched, to say the least. Laura Logan, who is an otherwise good journalist, she's been excommunicated from
huge cargo mainstream ship.
She's been, you know, she's been shunned from mainstream media, but she used to be on 60 Minutes. She's a journalist of some experience. She came right away with this could not have been an accident. You know what? Sometimes it's just an accident, and that happens at the very worst time. The fact that this happened at 1:30 in the morning sure is better than it happening at 1:30 in the afternoon, or we would have been talking about hundreds of people dead. So,
oh, yeah, right, right.
You know, it's amazing. But now, as you mentioned, you know, this is an important harbor, but especially for hazardous materials. I used to live in the Washington, D.C. area. I used to drive from Washington, D.C. up to Philadelphia several times a year. And so would go through a lot of these. I'm sure I went over that bridge more than once, but there's also tunnels that go underneath. But the hazardous materials, and that's, you know, who knew this? That Baltimore was kind of the epicenter of hazardous material movement internationally and nationally in the United States. You know, that's going to now be a big problem because you can't take the hazardous materials in the tunnels that go underneath the harbor. So, yeah, like you said, I'm really happy that Pete Buttigieg is on the case. Maybe he can bicycle over there and lead a recovery effort and speed up this bridge reconstruction, which I put the over under at the bridge reconstruction at 12 years. And I'm actually likely to take the over with the way we build things in this country now.
You know, I actually heard Pete Buttigieg is looking to take another 8 months off of paternity leave. So we'll see if he ever gets around to dealing with the bridge. Chris, yeah, lots of conspiracy theory stuff, cyber attack from China, bombs planted on the bridge, et cetera, et cetera. What were your initial thoughts to this story?
No, I agree with Jim. You know, I just think it's a terrible accident. And, you know, I was watching the coverage. Every single network was, you know, just doing this coverage nonstop that morning. I watched the press conference by the NTSB last evening. There wasn't really much in terms of breaking news there, although she did say that the cargo ship had 56 containers of hazardous material, and some of them had been breached, and some of them had possibly gone into the water. It's just that there was like a sheen on the water, so that is probably going to actually make
in Baltimore, where divers have recovered.
Keep going. Okay.
That's probably going to make the cleanup effort even longer because they're going to have to remove all those toxic substances. And Jim has the over under on 12 years. I am going so far over that. I'm thinking 20 years minimum.
Wow. Yeah. I think the average person doesn't understand how long this is going to be to clean up. I mean, and repair, right? Like, I was asking just some friends, like, how long do you think it's going to take? And I'm like, I don't know, a year or so? I'm like, it's going to take like 6 to 8 months just to clean up the bridge that's down in the water. But yeah, I love a good conspiracy theory. Love it. I've been called a conspiracy theorist probably more than most people, but I don't know. I kind of am I kind of try to steer away from that knee-jerk reaction of going straight to conspiracy theories. I think there's a lot of things kind of going on here that would kind of point in the opposite direction. One of our colleagues, Linnea Lucan, who you'll find on the Climate Realism Show weekly at the Heartland Institute main channel on YouTube, she said, from my perspective, as someone who's worked in heavy industry, I think most people would be shocked to know just how poor maintenance can get on ships, especially cargo ships. They have nearly no oversight, much less than vessels that are primarily passenger carrying, and it doesn't take much to get a power failure that takes out the thrusters. So yeah, I was looking into this, and there was some routine maintenance that was on this ship. It's called the MV Dolly container ship. There was some routine maintenance that it did in the harbor before it was leaving. So it was just routine maintenance, whatever. But another thing to consider was people are like, wow, you know, like this ship was going so slow. Like, how did the bridge like completely collapse like that? And it's because it's a massive, massive ship, right? I saw one story that was saying that if you were to tip it on its side and stand it straight up in the air, it would be about as tall as the Eiffel Tower. And the ship is incredibly big. Another little factoid is that the bridge was finished construction in like 1977 or something. And the largest container ship at that point in time was like a third the size of this one. So I don't think that this bridge was designed in any way to withstand a punch from a ship this big. So yeah. Also, these container ships go in and out of that port constantly. So the fact that like something like this would eventually happen, I think, is not unbelievable and necessitates some nefarious actors or anything like that. But yeah, I don't know. And I also think one other reason why I kind of steer away from conspiracy theories is I think that it kind of obscures other important aspects of these stories that we should talk about. And one of them has to do with just the bad, like, experience, I guess, that Pete Buttigieg has been having as the head of the Department of Transportation. I mean, in just his 4 years in that position, we've seen massive infrastructure issues, whether it's this bridge collapsing, which could be more about the ship and the maintenance of these sorts of ships, and all the airplane stuff that's been going on, all of the train derailments that happened a couple of years ago. And it's just like, is this all indicative of like crumbling United States infrastructure? Like, I feel like that's the conversation that we should all be having as opposed to conspiracy theories. And when I talk about like infrastructure, like I'm talking about actually like making bridges and roads and all of that better, not just putting up a bunch of EV charging stations around the country. Like, that's the infrastructure that I'm talking about. But I don't know. What do you think about that, Jim?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's right. I mean, you know, as much as I like to rip on the completely incompetent Pete Buttigieg, who never should have been appointed or approved, Senate should never have confirmed him as Secretary of Transportation, because he has no experience in it other than maybe building bike lanes in South Bend, Indiana. But, you know, a lot of our listeners obviously are actually from overseas and do a lot of international travel. And when you do that and you come back to the United States, you really kind of marvel at, you know, here is, you know, we're supposed to be the best at everything in America, right? We're number one, but we are like number 400 when it comes to our infrastructure. I mean, Sterling Burnett mentioned on the Climate Realism Show, I think either last week or the week before, on how the reason we have so many potholes and our highways are just complete messes and actually kind of dangerous, but German freeways are not that way, is because they dig the base of their roads much, much deeper than we do in the United States. And every time I go down Lake Cook Road to come here to the office in Northern Illinois, of the Heartland Institute, I have to go over Lake Cook Road is notoriously just pothole filled. It's uneven. Your car goes like this over the road. I mean, there's no excuse for that, unless your excuse is to make sure that the roads are crappy in this country so that you have full employment for road repair unionized crews. You know, it occurred to me that the number one reason we don't have better roads in this country is because it would put a lot of road workers out of work. So it's better that we just drive in their minds, I guess. It's better that we have crummy roads and jobs for people than to have good roads and maybe put those people on other kinds of jobs, like, I don't know, building a bridge that needs to be built across the harbor in Baltimore.
Yeah, Chris, final words on any of this. Do we need a real conversation when it comes to infrastructure in this country, or is this just kind of like a one-off crazy thing?
Well, first of all, I don't necessarily blame Pete Buttigieg for this. I think that, you know, this is actually symbolic of corporations taking their, you know, eyes off the ball. We've seen, you know, Boeing not put as much energy, effort, and resources into research and development, into safety inspections, because they only have limited resources, and some of those resources are needing to be deployed into things that have nothing to do with making airplanes like DEI. So that's one aspect of it. This particular ship also did have a history of accidents. It had an accident, I think, in the port of Netherlands like a year or so ago, where it damaged, you know, like the one of the concrete barriers there. And I also do think that we need to be spending more on this type of infrastructure. And like Jim was saying, you know, the United States infrastructure is not nearly as technological as other countries. And during the pandemic, we realized that the ports in particular were overrun with these union rules and restrictions. And they do not even allow robots and, you know, crane operated robots to remove these containers in many places. The Port of L.A. was just a horrible example. Total crazy backups, all sorts of problems there. So I think this also is just a lack of efficiency. And, you know, I know this is kind of going back a little ways, but The Wire actually did an entire season on the Baltimore ports and how corrupt they are and how the unions are just have run that thing into the ground. I wonder if there's something to do with that aspect of this.
Yeah, I forgot about that. The ports back up and the whole supply chain disruption and all of that. And how like it was so bad that like Joe Biden had to come in and like deregulate so that they could speed up the process and get this line of ships that went on for like miles, you know, to get through the ports and all of that. So yeah, just a whole nother thing.
And just one other real quick thing here. This also, I think, just shows once again how interconnected we are, this, you know, global economy. And if you've got a couple ports, you know, that are knocked off for whatever reason like this, this is going to have huge ramifications. A lot of cars from Europe arrive at this port. Mm-hmm. So this means the price of cars is probably going to go up. Like you said, a lot of hazardous materials, a lot of farm goods, agricultural goods arrive at this port. So this is going to have major consequences on the U.S. economy for, you know, months, if not years to come.
Yeah, pretty crazy stuff. But you know what? I will gladly eat my words if more information comes out in the coming weeks that shows that there is some crazy conspiracy and this was a cyber attack. I'll be the first to admit that I was wrong. They downloaded all the different like data from the travel logs or whatever the terminology is for this. And they were saying that they're going through it, but it might take, you know, another week or so to get any like conclusive findings about any of that stuff. So ongoing situation, and we will see, but we'll check in 12 years and see if Jim's over under wasn't accurate. So let's move on. So this, like I said, we're going to be covering a whole bunch of different topics, that being one of them. This one, I kind of making our main topic of the episode, and that it has to do with BlackRock and ESG divestment. So it has been a not so great week for BlackRock. Actually, it's been a not so great year or so for BlackRock. And I like to think that we played a role in that with our work on exposing ESG, the Great Reset, and so-called stakeholder capitalism. Our work on these issues has grown the awareness nationwide and frankly worldwide about the insidious nature of ESG corporate social credit scores and how they manipulate the economy and society by extension, and how those in positions of power behind those systems are able to wield incredible amounts of influence. So anyways, just recently, Texas announced they are terminating a massive $8.5 billion investment with BlackRock because of BlackRock's perceived boycott of energy companies. Quote, BlackRock's dominant and persistent leadership in the ESG movement immeasurably damages our state's oil and gas economy and the very companies that generate revenues for our permanent school fund, said Texas Board of Education Chairman Aaron Kinsey. BlackRock's destructive approach towards the energy companies that this state and our country depend on is incompatible with our fiduciary duty to Texans. Will Hurd, the executive director of the Consumers Research Group, said, under Larry Fink's leadership, BlackRock has been misusing clients' funds to push a political agenda for years. Nowhere was this more egregious than in Texas, where BlackRock was simultaneously trying to destroy the domestic oil and gas industry while managing funds that depended on royalties derived from that very same industry. A more flagrant violation of fiduciary duty is difficult to imagine. So, reading from this New York Post article that I have linked in the show notes, it says the action also represents by far the largest divestment of its kind since Republican-led states began terminating their financial ties to BlackRock and other financial institutions over their pursuit of so-called environmental, social, and governance ESG standards. The largest previous divestment was Florida's, worth $2 billion, announced by Florida Chief Financial Officer Jimmy Poutranis in December of 2022. So, Chris, I know that $8 billion or $8.5 billion is a huge number. And I also know that BlackRock manages somewhere in the range of $10 trillion or an even larger number. But this has still got to be something that turns BlackRock's head, right? I mean, that's a pretty substantial deinvestment here. What do you think about this story?
Yeah, no, this definitely is a pretty big disinvestment. It's the, like you said, it's the largest disinvestment of BlackRock to date. I did just read Larry Fink's latest 2024 letter to investors, and he didn't mention any of these states pulling money out. However, he did mention that BlackRock has received more than $1 trillion in net inflows over the past year. So I understand where you're coming from. You're saying, yeah, this is not going to ruin BlackRock by any means in the immediate future. But I do think that this is the, you know, we're seeing like a snowball effect here where it's just, it's gaining momentum. It's just growing and growing and growing. And on top of the Texas, announcement, we had Mississippi, I think it was their attorney general, announced yesterday that they are hitting BlackRock with a cease and desist order, telling them you cannot say that you are looking out for your shareholders' best interests because you aren't. And just like, you know, Texas is saying, wait a second, you're saying that you are not violating fiduciary duty, but when you are investing in green energy technologies and not investing in fossil fuel technologies in production, especially in a state like Texas, which that is one of their, you know, their major revenue sources, of course they are, you know, playing loose with the truth here. So I'm glad that, you know, Texas put their money where their mouth is. I think more states are going to follow, at least more red states are going to follow. I would love it if, you know, red state investors, you know, would also follow. But I think this is just a beginning of a long term thing that's going to occur. And it's probably going to hurt BlackRock's bottom line more than it's going to help it.
Yeah, Jim, I was going to bring up that other story, too. Yeah, Mississippi, they sent a cease and desist order, basically accusing BlackRock of misrepresenting their funds or something, saying that they're not related to ESG, some of their different investment vehicles and whatever, but, like, you know, at the end of the day they still are, or that the company itself is committed to pursuing these zero emissions things and all of that. So it's like within basically 7 days of each other we get this announcement from Texas, $8.5 billion being pulled out of BlackRock. We got Mississippi coming in with a cease and desist order. You've got like basically half of the country, the United States, is rightly identifying BlackRock as one of the biggest facilitators of the ESG scam, Larry Fink being the head of that. I mean, that just does not seem sustainable. I understand they're a massive asset management firm, assets totaling in the tens of trillions of dollars. But can you really operate like that for a long-term sense when you've got half of the country that's like seeing you as the bad guy? What do you think?
Yeah, you know, we have a clip here from Larry Fink where he kind of explains, and it's from I looked it up today, and it got a lot of traction last year in 2023, but it was actually an interview he did in 2017, and I'm not going to spoil it. We'll get to that setup in a minute. Although we just lost our producer who has the video. He just disappeared. So I'll have to vamp a bit, maybe pull it up in a minute. But, you know, another person on this podcast who we now have to just call a special guest when he decides to show up, and that being Justin Haskins. And you have wrote this book with Glenn Beck behind me called Dark Future, and it covers a lot of this stuff. And as you were setting me up here, Donnie, this phrase always comes to mind, but Margaret Thatcher, you said, you know, eventually you run out of other people's money. And she was talking about government programs and, you know, the lean towards socialism in the 1970s in Great Britain. And I think what Larry Fink and these other people that are trying to they're trying to socially engineer the world through financial markets, they're learning that eventually you lose too much money and you run out of other people's money, that those other people being you and me. If you have a mutual fund, if you have a financial advisor, he probably has your retirement tied up in these massive mutual funds like Vanguard and BlackRock. And these people like Larry Fink are playing around with the money that isn't theirs, but they have such power over it, being the heads of these massive mutual funds, that they just get these delusions of grandeur. And the left has been trying to impose its agenda upon an unwilling public in the United States and much of Western Europe, although to a lesser extent, because they tend to lean more left and more socialist. But especially in the United States, the American people, being freedom-oriented folk raised that way, at least my generation and earlier, kind of resist that sort of thing. And it was always very frustrating for the left, because they would take over academia, they take over Hollywood, they take over all of these institutions to impose their agenda, but they can't really seem to make any traction. And then they realize, well, the last frontier, the one we really should have gone for all along, is the investment companies, is the private sector, is to impose our agenda to basically what ESG is about. And you alluded to it in the story, or it was mentioned in the story by the New York Post, you know, making it illegal to invest or support financially any of the stuff that we don't like, anything that goes against our agenda, anything that gives Americans in particular more freedom, that being cheap energy. So when you get a good ESG score by divesting from fossil fuel companies, that's the imposition of a leftist mindset through the most powerful avenue you can, which is through the markets. And so you end up taking them over. You know, like we talk about, Donnie, you and I watched the show The Last of Us, which is based on a video game in which Morspolds take over the body of the host and the brain of the host. And the host isn't dead. It's alive, but it's controlled by this nefarious mold. And it does the will. The body now does the will of that invader. And I think that's a good way to think about what these...
That is a good way. I like that analogy, Jim.
Yeah, you like that?
That's good. That's good.
Because that's what's happening in our financial markets, is that the left is like a nefarious mold that has now controlling the host body, which is capitalism. So they start using terms like stakeholder capitalism instead of shareholder capitalism, because their agenda is what's number one. Not making money for you, not making sure that you can have a nice retirement through your investments, but to make sure that the agenda is pushed and anything that goes against the agenda is attacked. And that's what the intent of Larry Fink and all of these people are. And that's what ESG has always been about. It's about changing the world into a leftist perspective and using the most powerful lever they can, which is our markets, to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's always been the idea of like kind of the collective action being using the government as like a tool to achieve societal goals. And this is just so much more of like an insidious one, because it's like in the United States, it's more of like a self-imposed sort of control where everyone's kind of buying into this thing. You know, everyone that wants to be part of the game has to buy into this ESG scam here. And because when you do that, now you're putting these goals as the manipulating factors that are pushing where you should be going as a corporation. Are you going to be chasing the customer's wants and needs and that sort of price signals and supply and demand, that sort of thing? No, we're going to push towards this, where we have to play by these rules established by the people setting up the ESG game, and therefore we're going to head in this direction instead. And so at worst, I always say this, at best, it's the biggest cronyist system ever devised by man.
Oh, yeah.
If you want to be part of the system, you have to play these rules. Biggest cronyist system ever devised by man. At worst, this is a backdoor collectivist system controlled by the you know, global elite types to control society. And I think we have that clip real quick, Chris, because we have a clip of Larry Fink basically saying this. So if we have that clip, Andy, and we can play it, go ahead and play that Larry Fink clip, please.
It's just, you have to force behaviors. And if you don't force behaviors, whether it's gender or race or just any way you want to say the composition of your team, you're going to be impacted. And that's not just not recruiting. It is development, as Ken said.
How do you force change, though? I mean, Larry, BlackRock has really been on the forefront of the ESG movement within corporate governance and a real leader. And yet change is so slow. So what is, and Ken as well, how do you force change when it is so incremental and so gradual? How do you do something more radical? Have you thought about that? Has the board of American Express thought about more radical things we could do to enhance diversity and inclusion?
Because it has to be imbued in the culture of a firm. It has to be talked about. It has to be shown. Behaviors across the entire firm in every region have to be similar. And every citizen of the firm has to understand what is acceptable behaviors and what are unacceptable behaviors.
Yeah, there are other clips too. I don't know if there might actually be like video clips of this, but one that I always keep in mind is Brian Moynihan, who is like the head of Bank of America. And he basically flat out said, like, if you don't play the ESG game, you're not going to have access to money. Like, you're not going to have access to loans and all of that sort of stuff. Like, and I think he said that during like a Davos thing. I know it's in one of the books. It might be in Dark Future. It might be in the Great Reset book. But flat out say these things, man. They flat out say it. But Chris, you were going to jump in earlier. Go ahead.
Yeah. So in his most recent letter to investors, which came out, I think, about a week ago, he did not mention ESG once. I read the entire thing. I did a control F search for it. ESG did not mention. It was not mentioned once. But here was actually what the 2024 letter to investors was all about. It was all about retirement. And he says, we cannot depend on Social Security for retirement. So he then says, we have to invest in places like BlackRock. And then he talks about securitization. And he talks about, it's great when you are hopeful about capital markets, because then when you invest a dollar in BlackRock, then BlackRock can go and use that dollar to invest. And he cited the multiplier effect, which is not exactly, economically valid in my mind. But the reason I bring this all up is because, you know, Donnie, we're talking a lot about the fact that you don't actually own the securities in your accounts. So when he is saying, give us all your money, we will invest it for you, really what he's saying is invest in BlackRock funds, ETFs or whatever, so that we can then use that money to make other investments. And many times we're going to bet against, you know, the United States, because he has all sorts of bets in China and China energy and all sorts of stuff. So really what he cited the 2008 Great Recession and how, well, that was securitization gone a little bit amok, because then they started making bets against the mortgages that they had sold in the first place. So what I'm I'd say I'm worried that he's pivoting in a new direction now, in which he's saying it's not about ESG. It's all about just trust us. Put all your money in BlackRock ETFs. If you've got pensions or whatever, just invest it all. We are the best of the best. He would, was saying we've 9,000% return since 1999, blah, 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 all this stuff. And I think that really what he's saying is, hey, give us your money so that we can then use it in the derivatives market to make way, way, way more money. And we'll just see what happens at the end. And I think that it's going to end in a really, really destructive, bubble that we have not seen ever in, human history. So I think that we should be very, very concerned with the agenda of people like Larry Fink and BlackRock, because they control tens and tens of trillions of dollars. they have immense influence over the financial markets. And if they are now saying that capitalization and capital markets are the solution to everything, and living within your means, whether it's as a country or as a family or as a company or whatever, he's saying, oh, that's old fashioned. That's quaint. It's all about, racking up more debt, more investment. And, to me, that's just like a recipe for utter disaster. I think this makes ESG look like it's not even that big of a deal if you really think about that.
Yeah, it's funny when BlackRock, we talk about BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street, right? And the tens of trillions of dollars that they have. And then you compare it to like the Heartland Institute, who's been at the forefront of this ESG fight for a little while now, and just kind of a band of other like-minded organizations that are trying to push back against this, and some courageous state lawmakers that are taking a stand against it, and some of these states that are pushing back against it. And like comparatively to those other organizations, the Vanguards, the State Streets, and the Black Rocks, it's like this is all small potatoes, yet we're getting them to react. They're the giant elephant and we're like the little mouse that's scaring them. So as long as we keeping their feet to the fire and all of that, I think we can make some substantial changes. Although you have to be aware of the way that they try to hoodwink you. Like, we're just not going to call it ESG. That term has been too politicized. We're going to call it something else. We'll call it sustainability plans or conscious capitalism or one of a number of millions of terms that their PR department at these firms are coming up with. So we'll keep on this fight and we'll keep you posted about everything ESG related. But the past couple of weeks having some of these movements, it fills me with joy. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah. I mean, just getting back to that Larry Fink clip, I mean, the thing that really perks your ears up is his just how casually just says, we need to force behavior. Well, who the hell asked you? I mean, who elected you the czar of the global economy, and that which you must use your power, enormous power, to force behaviors? And of course, the implication there, I'm sure it was explained in a longer in the full interview. But his position is that your company is not going to be getting any capital, any investment. And without that capital investment, your company is going to die. That's how you force behavior, because it's otherwise people wouldn't do it. It's just by definition. You do if you're forced to do something, it means you wouldn't otherwise want to do it or didn't think it was a good thing to do for your business or whatever. And then what are they forcing you to do? They're forcing you to make real the leftist slogan that diversity is our strength. Now, that may be true in a lot of circumstances. It may not be true in some select circumstances, but as is the nature of the left, conformity is what's absolutely important. So diversity must be everywhere. Now, with diversity in an NBA basketball team, when we're talking about racial and gender checkboxes and sexual orientation checkboxes, would enforcing diversity, forcing behavior like diversity on an NBA basketball team, would that be their strength? Would that make that basketball team a better basketball team? No, of course not. But you want the most talented people you can find. And if diversity is something, if racial or gender or sexual diversity is something you want in your company, because that's a value you hold, you may pursue that more vigorously than somebody else. But most companies and most going concerns, most organizations of any kind, including the Heartland Institute, just want to attract as many and the most talented people they can to fulfill their mission, which is either to make money or, in the case of the Heartland Institute, to advance freedom, to communicate the ideas that we do here on this podcast and as an organization every single day. But again, the left is not satisfied. And that's where this all came from. They got impatient. They were tired. They've been preaching all of their messaging, a lot of it hippy dippy stuff that most Americans would just ignore or maybe only half-heartedly pursue. And they were sick of it. And they said, we have this power and we must enforce it, to the fact that your company will no longer be getting any investments because we have decided that you are not pushing our agenda hard enough. And that's where all this comes from. And so Larry Fink, that was from 2017. And it really only started to get traction and people started noticing it only in 2023. So yes, these are, just to go right back to the beginning thing I said, we can move on to the other topics, but you know, Justin, when this first started happening, when the first states were saying, nope, we're divesting from BlackRock, you can't be imposing this woke BS on this state. We're taking our public funds out of your mutual fund. And Justin would be like, you know, what's a couple million dollars? That doesn't mean anything. So, well, hey, it was $2 billion. That's nothing. That's like leaving an extra dollar tip at the diner for these guys. It's nothing. But you have to start somewhere. And what's really great is that over the last year, as you said, this has not been a great, I guess, last year, if you were to just make the last 12 months, it has not been great for the ESG movement and the DEI movement in our corporate structures and our powerful corporate titans in this country. And it's happened little by little. And now they're realizing that the ESG investment scheme, the scam, is costing people money, and it's soon going to start to cost people their jobs. And eventually, hopefully, we'll be able to get back to actual normal operating procedures for corporations and for your investments.
Yeah, we got H. Sterling Burnett in the chat right now, and he hat tip to him because he points out the latest term coming from the Black Rocks and the Larry Finks is energy pragmatism. That's what we're going for. It's not ESG. It's not any of this stuff that's become politically loaded. It's this next fresh and clean term that we're going to come up with, energy pragmatism. Doesn't that sound great? That just sounds like we're doing what everybody should be doing. So yeah, just wait till they complain about that being a politicized term in the next several months. But their scheme will never die. They've put all of their eggs in this basket. All of this has to do with the control and, like I said, the biggest cronyist system ever devised by man. So they can't just let it go and return back to sound capitalism, supply and demand, basic economic principles. They're going to move forward with this, and we're going to be pushing back every step of the way. Let's move on to our next topic here, though. So this next story, I am admittedly not super well-versed on. I see some basics, but you two are going to have to fill in the gaps for me. But NBC News announced that they are going to hire Ronna McDaniel, a former chairman of the Republican National Committee, as a paid contributor for the network. This caused an utter meltdown with the normally level-headed MSNBC personalities like Joy Reid and Rachel Maddow and others. Not only did they sound their displeasure with the move to hire McDaniel, they dedicated airtime to criticizing the move and demanding McDaniel not be hired by the network or let go, I guess. Network leadership acknowledged the concerns from their employees, but assured them that this was a business decision, and despite their differences of opinion with the MSNBC hosts, that they were going to keep McDaniel on. Nah, I'm just kidding. They fired her like 2 days later. So, Jim, is my description of the events accurate enough? walk us through this a little bit.
Yeah, well, so we have a couple of clips that we can play. One was the one that made the noise over the weekend was Chuck Todd, who used to be the host of Meet the Press. And he got fired from that job because the ratings were crap and he's garbage. And so, you know, but he was a guest on it instead. And it people found it remarkable that he was calling out his own company on the air for having the temerity to hire Ronna McDaniel, who is about as milquetoasty and Romney-esque Republican as you can get, to be a paid contributor to, I don't know, maybe give some insight to one half of the country and their views on political and current events. Nope, that was too much for him to handle. And he called him out. You want to just go ahead and play the video?
Sure. Yeah, let's go ahead. Which one? The Chuck Todd one?
Chuck Todd one, yeah.
All right. Yeah, let's play that.
Let me deal with the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
I think our bosses owe you an apology for putting you in this situation because I don't know what to believe. She is now a paid contributor by NBC News. So I have no idea whether any answer she gave to you was because she didn't want to mess up her contract. She wants us to believe that she was speaking for the RNC when the RNC was paying for it. So she has credibility issues that she still has to deal with.
Yeah.
Is she speaking for herself or is she speaking on behalf of who's paying her? What, once at the RNC, she did say that, hey, I'm speaking for the party. I get that. That's part of the job. So what about here? I will say this. I think your interview did a good job of exposing, I think, many of the contradictions. And look, there's a reason why there's a lot of journalists at NBC News uncomfortable with this, because many of our professional dealings with the RNC over the last 6 years have been met with gaslighting. have been met with character assassination. So it is, you know, that's where you begin here. And so when NBC made the decision to give her NBC News' credibility, you got to ask yourself, what does she bring NBC News?
Oh, my God.
They're masquerading as adults here. Like this is a professional setting. Is this, did we just like accidentally turn the cameras on during like a little, gripe session during lunch break or something? Like what is going on here, Jim?
Well, I mean, it would be the equivalent of us using this platform, our YouTube platform to rip the Heartland Institute and a new right. one and talk publicly about, mistakes it's made in its decisions, you know. But the idea, I mean, gosh, this is risking the credibility of NBC News. Are you kidding me? I mean, if our ears muted all gaslighting, then all of NBC's programming would be a silent movie, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
Almost every expert and that they've hired as a political analyst at NBC is a former lying hack for the Democrats. I mean, for crying out loud, they were negotiating a new show for White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki while she was still White House spokeswoman, and landed the deal while she was still White House spokesperson. Hiring the former head of the Republican National Committee to give some insight is somehow ruining their credibility. Are you kidding me? Chuck Todd himself is a former Democratic Senate staffer. Jen Psaki, just mentioned, she was a gaslighter and a liar for Obama and Biden. Robert Gibbs, another one of their usual contributors, former Obama spokesperson. Ben Rhodes, this is one of my favorite ones when I was thinking this over. He's an MSNBC contributor. He famously bragged that he lied repeatedly to reporters covering the White House about the Iran deal and all sorts of other stuff because they, quote, know nothing and they're so easy to manipulate. He's on MSNBC. That doesn't hurt their credibility. And then, of course, there's Al Sharpton, who instigated anti-Jewish race riots in New York City that got people killed, including Black people killed in the 1990s. He has his own show on NBC and it's been, I don't know, what has he been with him for like 20 years? I mean, we could go on and on and on with this stuff. All of these networks, I mean, George Stephanopoulos, you know, he's a former communications director for Bill Clinton. And as soon as he left the White House, he got handed a job at ABC News. The revolving door between being a Democratic political operative and being a journalist on our corrupt legacy media has been spinning very fast for a long, long time. And so, you know, they do have a couple of non-Democratic operatives on the air on these networks, but every one of them, without exception, is a Trump-hating lunatic who considers half this country to be deplorable white supremacists or Christian nationalists, whatever the heck that is, and that they consider that the MAGA agenda to be just like Germany's in the 1930s. This is not an exaggeration. Chris will back me up because he watches these networks more than I do. It's set up this way because they had to get rid of Ronald McDaniel because nothing is going to disturb their narrative that democracy itself is on the ballot and we're going to lose our precious democracy if Trump wins. That was the message in 2020, and it's the message now, and they're turning it up to 11.
Yeah, Chris, I mean, did you have the privilege of watching some of the outrage on MSNBC over this issue?
Yeah, Lawrence O'Donnell went absolutely crazy. O'Donnell. Rachel Maddow went totally crazy. Morning Joe, Mika, and Joe went totally bonkers about this. The Lauren O'Donnell one, I thought it was particularly entertaining because he said it was all about the fact that she embraced the 2020 stolen election stuff and that he would refuse to have anyone on his show who had anything to say other than the 2020 election was the most safe and secure in all of human history. Donnie, last time I checked, you know, we did a report and the 2020 election was far from the most safe and secure in modern history. So you would think that as journalists, they would actually want to dig into these stories. These are that potentially is the story of a century. But no. They want to protect the Democrat Party at all costs because they are an instrument of the Democrat Party. And like Jim said, I mean, man, the list is even longer than that. How about David Axelrod? How about Clapper? How about all the? These are all paid contributors to MSNBC for the most part, and some appear on CNN as well. You know, it's just so funny because Donnie, and you know, I've told you this so many times, 10, 15, 20 years ago, you know, when I was just kind of starting to like get interested in all this kind of stuff, I would watch CNN. Guess what? CNN had a show called Crossfire in which Sean Hannity and Sean Combs. Was it Sean Combs?
No. That was Hannity and Combs on Hannity Fox. Combs. It was Tucker Carlson.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Exactly. And that was the norm. The norm was that you would have both sides. They would get into a pretty good debate on the issue, and then you would let the viewers decide. That has completely ceased to exist. Now, if you watch NBC, MSNBC in particular, it is just straight Democrat Party talking points. They aren't presenting the news. They aren't presenting the news at all. All they do is talk Trump, 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 GOP, GOP, GOP. That's all they do. That's it. But if you watch Fox, because I do watch Fox, I, you know, flip through these channels on a regular basis every single day, because that's part of my job is to stay very up to date on what's going on in the media universe on this stuff. Fox, on the other hand, on all of their shows, has both sides of the argument presented, whether it's the five or whether it's outnumbered, whether it's even Sean Hannity and, you know, Jesse Waters primetime. They always go out of their way to have a leftist, if you want to call that, type of guest, you know, and they actually have a discourse. That's the best way to get to the bottom of these, you know, sorts of things, whether it's, you know, the election in 2020 or it's, you know, any policy and anything, cultural, whatever. The best thing to do is have a vigorous discourse. MSNBC, CNN, and the rest of the mainstream media do not want to do that. And I think it's also because they don't want to get into a discourse because they know that their position on most of these issues is horrible. And they know that Americans disagree with them on most of these issues. So they are afraid to have the other side present the argument. So it's much easier for them to vilify the other side and for Rachel Maddow and Joy Reid and all them to just, you know, get in these conversations amongst themselves where they're just constantly berating Trump, berating any sort of free market policy, berating the Republican Party, berating, you know, white men or whatever. And they never have to deal with someone from the other side saying, hey, did you ever consider this? So I think that is what this is really about.
Yeah, Sean Hannity and Sean P. Diddy Combs, I think, would be a great show for MSNBC to consider. But we've got another clip here, and trigger warning, everybody, because this is Rachel Maddow for about 2.5 minutes. But it, again, just highlights the absolute meltdown that these folks were having. I didn't realize that basically every show, like, Chris, you listed off like every show that they have. Every show was commenting on this story. That seems...
Oh, and just one more thing. You know, one of the golden rules in media is you don't talk about your actual media brand, whether it's like a newspaper, like talking about themselves. Like Jim said, at the Harlan Institute, we would never do that on air. But it's especially true and especially relevant when you're talking about a media company like 30 Rock. That was the number one topic on every single show the day that that announcement was, the day that the hiring was announced. And that was what they did. They went and used their news programs to get on a pedestal and soapbox and try to lecture the American people about how Ronna McDaniel does no place on the airwaves. Donnie, this is just exactly what we talk about with censorship, with you know, viewpoint discrimination, with all that stuff. It's getting to the point now where they're just saying, no, you don't even have a right to you know, state what you believe in. That is super scary stuff. That is, you know, right. Soviet Union, Nazi Germany, you know, Red China stuff.
Jim, do you want to play this clip or not?
Yeah, I do want to play the clip.
So. All right, let's play the clip. Go ahead and play the Rachel Maddow clip. Everyone, brace yourselves.
And this project is now ongoing, right? Now the project is to tell the American people that those efforts around the 2020 election were righteous. That 2020 election, it wasn't okay. Those election results were not correct. We shouldn't believe American elections. We shouldn't believe American elections are real elections. American election results should not be seen as real. They should not be respected. That's the project now, right? I mean, it didn't work to overthrow the government the last time, but as long as you can build on that first effort, as long as you can keep up the anti-election mythology, then you are priming your people. You're priming the American public to not accept the results of the next election.
I'm pausing it just for a second. Is there no self-awareness at all? Are you kidding me with this whole rejection of election results as if that's just like a historically unknown thing that's only ever happened on the right? There's no history of the left ever disputing election. Go ahead. Sorry.
All right. Yeah, I know. Keep your eyes on the screen, though. There you go.
You're telling them that they're going to need to take power by other means because the election isn't going to be how we do it anymore.
Oh, my God.
You're also priming people, honestly, to vote to give up this supposed democracy we have, because what good is it anyway? Right? So what are we really losing if we decide we're going to lose this? Who cares? Elections are fraudulent here anyway. Who cares if we give them up? Ronna McDaniel has been pitching in on that, too, continuing to say since 2020 that that election wasn't right, that the American public should know that that vote wasn't real. And that is a message not only about 2020, but about this next election and about whether or not elections should matter at all and whether we should bother having them at all. The Republican Party getting behind that message is a choice. I mean, Trump himself is going to do what he wants to do. We've always had guys like Trump. Sometimes they were ridiculous little uniforms, right? But we've always had guys like that. We've never before had a big, storied, important American political institution embrace a guy like that. We are contending with this now, not from William Dudley Pelley's brown shirt militias, right? But from the multi-billion dollar massive political operation of one of the two governing parties of the United States of America. And that's new. And with our country up against something that daunting and that scary and that dangerous for the country, I think bad decisions will inevitably happen. Mistakes will be made. But part of our resilience as a democracy is going to be recognizing when decisions are bad ones and reversing those bad decisions. Hearing legitimate criticism, responding to it, and correcting course. Not digging in, not blaming others. Take a minute. Acknowledge that maybe it wasn't the right call.
Oh, my God.
It is a sign of strength, not weakness, to acknowledge when you were wrong. It is a sign of strength. And our country needs us to be strong right now.
This is painful. This is painful to listen to. I the state of our media system is it. I don't know how you do it, Chris. I really don't know how you do it. When I was looking up clips for last week, whatever we talked about that related to the media, it was the bloodbath stuff. I was absolutely blown away by their takes on that bloodbath thing. This might be worse. It gets worse every week.
That's just par for the course. I mean, maybe it's just so ingrained in me because I've been doing it for so many years that it's just like, that doesn't shock me one iota, really, to be honest with you. But Donnie, you know, one of the differences between the, I hate to do this, like the Fox versus MSNBC or Fox versus CNN, but to be honest with you, Fox is the only real mainstream, quote, like right-leaning media cable news channel. So I kind of have to use them as my default. Go and watch Fox News for a day. It's fun. They're laughing. They're having a good time. They're having, they are celebrating America. Yes, they get into the problems. Of course they do. But it's done in a way in which it's actually fun to watch. MSNBC, CNN, it's not fun. All they do is they lecture their viewers. All they do is talk about how we're on the verge of, catastrophe if Donald Trump would somehow win in 2024. It's just not fun. And that, I wonder if that is also a part of why no one watches that, because no one wants to just be constantly, constantly lectured again and again and again with the same tired talking points. And that's what MSNBC is. It's a bunch of killjoys. That's literally what it is. Always talking about, how climate change is going to ruin, the world. And, we must, have unfettered abortions, just like on and on and on. Maybe that's why people don't tune into that. Well, maybe it would be in their best interest to say, you know what, let's go in the total opposite direction. Let's actually make it somewhat fun. Let's make it engaging for the viewer. And let's actually treat the viewer like they are, smart, informed person. Give them, a sophisticated, dialogue here and let them make their minds up. But that is not what happens on MSNBC at all.
Jim, if if Rachel Maddow is so concerned that what, you know, the Republicans are doing or whatever, priming the public for this and that and all, what is she doing to the public? What is she priming the public for when she constantly labels Trump a fascist and makes comparisons, not even that thinly veiled comparisons to Hitler and all of that? What is she priming the public for? Again, is there no self-awareness? Sorry, but this is just, it's hard for me to look at.
There is that, no self-awareness.
And not, I want to like write it off as a joke, like clown world stuff. But like, I can't not take it seriously. Like, this is just, it's absolutely bizarre to me. But I don't know. What are your, let's make this the final thoughts and we'll wrap it up for today.
All right. Well, you know, I wish you didn't get triggered at the 44-second mark, because at the 45-second mark, I had a Star Wars themed visual joke that you had. I saw you had closed your eyes and you missed it. So now you can
I'm sorry. I'll have to watch it later.
It was just for you, too. And you just you blew it anyway. But yeah, I'm kind of sorry to inflict that on you guys. I mean, I know it's painful even to our audience, you know, but we have to see what's going on. And though Rachel Maddow is the highest rated show on the lowest rated cable network, I mean, this mindset, Donnie, it rules the Democratic Party, and it's the mindset of our ruling class. And it's even the mindset of the jury pools in blue cities, as Trump and his supporters and even Mark Stein found out not too long ago. But let's remember, though, why Maddow is clutching her pearls on her giraffe sized neck. It's because Ronna McDaniel does not believe that the 2020 election was fair. McDaniel believes that the 2020 election was rigged. It was not fortified. All right. In fact, the fortification of the election was the rigging. I mean, from Pennsylvania to Georgia to Wisconsin and all these key swing states, you know, they threw out the normal election rules. We've talked about this a lot. You know, they were counting ballots that were illegally submitted that would not have been counted in 2016. But that was just fine in 2020. And it gave Biden the narrowest of victories that he needed to defeat Donald Trump. And all this, of course, remember, because they scared us. They spent a year, these same media outlets spent a year scaring us about a pandemic, saying you would all die if you voted in person. Total lie. Total lie. These are also the same hacks who have the vapors, again, of this Romney-like Republican, about as milquetoast as it can get. She's hardly some big MAGA, you know, MAGA person. It's not like they hired Donald Trump Jr. or something, right? You know,
yeah, right.
But these same people that have the vapors over this were totally fine saying that Trump stole the 2016 election with the help of Russia. Maddow herself called Trump literally a Russian asset sitting in the White House. These same people pushed the Russia collusion lie. They called a riotous protest at the Capitol an armed insurrection when it was not. They colluded with the January 6th committee, which was just a partisan hit job, to falsely paint that as a way to poison the DC jury pool. And now many innocent people or who committed no worse than a misdemeanor have been spending years in jail. They peddled disgust. These are the same people peddled disgusting lies about Brett Kavanaugh to keep him off the Supreme Court. They said Trump was putting kids in cages when Obama was doing the same thing. They say there's right now there's no border crisis. They tell us that the economy is doing great. They peddled the don't say gay bill lie to attack Ron DeSantis. And right now they are busy covering up that Biden has lost his mind to dementia and while peddling all of the administration's lies and gaslighting. And this is the network for which Ronna McDaniel is too much over the line. Now, the reason I thought it was important to get to this, because it really does reveal the mindset, not just of our corrupt corporate media, but of our ruling class entirely. And it is way out of touch with ordinary Americans. And guys, it's only spring. Wait until late summer or early fall if Trump is up again in the polls, especially in the swing states. I shudder to think that we may look back at the stuff that just triggered you so badly, Donnie, and look back at it, that hysteria, as the good times when things were pretty reasonable, because it's only going to get worse.
Yeah, yeah. I think if you wanted to torture me, all you have to do is tie me to a chair and turn on MSNBC. I think I would give away state secrets within 5 minutes. Like that's how torturous that is to me. Rough stuff. Also, Jim, while you were talking, I did check out what your visual joke was on that clip. That was pretty genius. Chris, your final words, and we'll wrap it up today.
Yeah, I just want to circle back to what you were saying about are they this like unself-aware? Was that what we were the topic?
Oh, that was part of it, yeah.
Okay, sure. So here's my take on that. I think you need to understand that these people hang out in the same small elite liberal circles. They do not venture outside of that ever for any purpose. Because, I mean, I watch these shows. They'll talk about, you know, I spent the weekends in the Hamptons, you know, and blah, blah, blah. They never, you know, I talk about, yeah, you know, I went in and you know, was hobnobbing with, you know, just average everyday Americans, you know, or dare I say Trump supporters. So I think the reason why they have this, you know, just completely warped sense of the country is because they don't interact with everyday, ordinary, hardworking Americans. And one of the things that I think this really, really springs from is in 2016, when Hillary Clinton lost in the upset of all upsets, you would have thought that the Democratic Party would have said, hey, you know what? Maybe there's a reason why these disaffected, you know, ex-Democrats are voting for Donald Trump, especially in places like the Rust Belt. No, they didn't do that at all. What did they do? They called them deplorables for four straight years. All they do was just say you're a racist, you're a homophobe, you're this, you're that, you're the worst, you know, of ever, instead of just trying to actually understand them. And the only way you can understand people is by having a dialogue with them. I've got lots of very liberal friends. Donnie, you and I were talking about this. The best thing for us to do is to sit down and just have conversations. And 9 times out of 10, we find out that we have a lot more in common than we actually don't. And I wish for once that these people would just open up their minds and allow someone like a Ronna McDaniel to go on air and to actually, you know, have a genuine back and forth with her, try to understand, why are half of Americans really upset with the way that things are going? Why are half of Americans really frustrated with the border? Why are half of Americans really frustrated with, you know, crime running rampant in these cities? Defund the police. But no, they don't want to have that conversation. They just want to stay in their tiny little echo chambers and just keep rehashing the same talking points amongst each other. And that's why, but just real quick, that's why it's so boring to watch those channels, because I know going in, okay, any subject, they're just going to take the anti-Trump, anti-free market, anti, you know, right approach. Versus on Fox, you actually have people, whether it's Brian Kilmeade or Steve Doocy in the morning, or, you know, Sean Hannity at night, or Jesse Waters, who sometimes just surprise you and say, actually, I'm totally opposite. I'm going to go this way. Tucker Carlson was also really good about doing that. That challenges me to think about these things in totally different ways. That's why when I'm watching Fox in you know, shows and, you know, documentaries like that, it's great because you're getting both sides and it's forcing you to actually have that critical thinking analysis occur within your brain versus watching MSNBC, where all you are is just like being spoon-fed Democrat talking points again and again and again.
Well,
that
also,
is the biggest difference.
Isn't this like indicative of just like the way that they view their viewers as well?
Absolutely.
Like they don't have trust in their viewers to hear a dissenting opinion and be able to like understand why it's wrong or anything like that. It's like, we have to protect these people from dissenting opinions. We can't allow them to hear what the other side is.
And I
always say this because, you know, people will say, well, what about the right and stuff like that? And I feel like we don't even have the privilege, the opportunity as much to live in an echo chamber, because so much of the media that just is like constantly around us, whether it's just like TV and movies or just like late night shows or anything like that, is all embedded with the same sort of, you know, mainstream media talking points and rhetoric that, like, when you do turn on Fox News, it's just like counter narrative stuff to what you're constantly surrounded in, right? So it's like, we don't have like the privilege of being able to live in an echo chamber where they're over there making sure that even the slightest sliver of you know, opinion from the other side is not allowed on our channel. Like it's a really, really unbelievable thing.
And I was just gonna say, I draw parallels between this and my experience teaching high school, because I taught high school American government, U.S. history, world history. I know a lot of teachers took their students and just said, I'm going to tell them what to think. And I was always like, no, that's not the way to do it. You give them both sides and then you allow them to form their own opinion. That's why it is so important to build critical thinking skills. And the modern media complex, whether it's, you know, the social media platforms, TikTok. It's all about just these short little sound bites, and just they just kill you with repetition. Mm-hmm. Fox, generally speaking, on the other hand, doesn't do that. They go very in depth on these issues. They give you both sides, and they say, and this is actually one of their taglines, let the viewer decide. That is why actually a lot of Democrats, if you look at the ratings, Democrats watch Fox News so much because I think they actually appreciate that. And that's the way it used to be on MSNBC back in the day. That's the way it used to be on CNN. And that's why I think that their ratings have just gone, you know, into a total nosedive, because half of America wants nothing to do with that. This is my job. So I watch just because, you know, I'm supposed to observe, you know, the mainstream media, and I want to stay very up to date on this stuff. But yeah, I mean, this is just, and it's, you know what? It's getting worse, not better. Yeah. Oh, that's the really so scary part. Yeah.
It's getting so much worse. All right, Jim, take us home.
Yeah, you know, so you alluded to this, but you guys may recall the brief moment when the legacy media, they were blindsided by Trump's election in 2016, and they said that they needed to understand and start to platform the people who supported him. I believe it was the New York Times said we need to solicit op-eds from Trump supporters because we need to understand what just happened, because none of us saw this coming, right? But I don't believe they ever ran any of those op-eds, as a matter of fact. And in fact, they ran off editors at the New York Times who dared to just run a piece by a sitting United States senator while all the riots were going on around the country. That caused the entire opinion page of the New York Times to basically commit suicide, professional suicide on itself. And so they haven't learned anything. But very soon, though, they decided, and this is why they didn't do this, because they decided on their own that Trump supporters, half of this country, and the Make America Great Again movement was a barely veiled white supremacist, semi-fascist, Christian nationalist, and a danger to democracy. These people obviously are very out of touch with America, but they promote this propaganda because they know propaganda works, and especially for half this country. That's why they do it.
Jim, I don't think they actually
believe that. You have people in your family, you have friends who watch this and who believe this. And that itself, that is the real danger to our country and to democracy. That people believe these lies and these smears, and frankly, the almost unpersoning of anybody who dare not vote for Joe Biden and would vote for Donald Trump. But unlike the left, and what was going on here with the Ronald McDaniel thing, you know, we don't call for the censorship of people like Rachel Maddow and all of these absolute lunatics, but they call for the censorship of people like us, and they use their positions of power to make sure that censorship is carried out. And again, those are the real dangers to our democracy, not the fact that half this country rejects leftism.
Yep. It's a topic that, like I said, or like Chris said, seems to be getting worse and worse. It seems like every week or so, there's at least one story that kind of highlights this this idea that the state of the media is getting worse, more fraction, more polarized. And, you know, it's just seemingly leading to a destabilization of just the political discourse in this country.
Can I make
gonna wrap it up, but Chris wants to make a couple points, so
just two very, very walk off points. First of all, I do think that Rachel Maddow and all the people at MSNBC know that they are peddling lies to the American people. I absolutely believe that. And second, I think that this is exactly what they want. They want to create a safe space for liberals to sit there and just get, you know, indoctrinated and brainwashed with their liberal talking points, just like it's happened at higher education institutions throughout the nation. It's happening in the mainstream media as well.
No doubt. We'll be covering it every week on the In the Tank podcast. I want to thank all of you for joining us for this week. Join us every week for a new episode. For those audio only listeners that are catching this on probably a Friday or later, you can first off leave a review for us on iTunes. That would be greatly appreciated. You could also join us live where we are streaming this on Facebook and YouTube and X and Rumble and whatever, where we are streaming it on Thursdays at noon Central Time. You can join the conversation, throw your comments and questions in the chat. Maybe we'll show your comment on the screen. Maybe we'll address your questions on the fly. You can support the show by just doing a handful of things. Hitting that like button, sharing this content, subscribing if you haven't already, or just leaving a comment under the video all helps break through those big tech algorithms that prevent content like this from being shown to more people. If you'd like, you could follow us on X at In the Tank Pod, or send us your comments, questions or suggestions for the show by emailing us at theinthetankpodcast@gmail.com. And I do really encourage you to do that. There was an episode not long ago where we went really in depth into Chinese propaganda network, global propaganda network. And that was all as a result of a fan submitted just a video that kind of set me down a rabbit hole. And we did a whole episode on that. I was actually just looking at those notes recently, so that's why it came to mind. So again, inthetankpodcast@gmail.com. Jim Lakely, where can the fine people find you?
At J Lakely on X, at Heartland Inst on X, and always visit heartland.org.
Fantastic. And Chris Talgo, what do you have to pitch today?
Well, if you're in the Arlington Heights area, next week we are having a great event with Larry Schweikert, and he's going to be talking about his new book about globalization and globalism and how it's not good for humanity. So please, if you can't attend, I think it will be live streamed. So definitely check that out. Yeah, he's a great author.
Fantastic. Everyone have a great holiday weekend, and we will talk to you next week.
He's a lion dog-faced pony soldier. He's a lion dog-faced pony soldier.